This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. This is episode, lands, I don't know, 435. I don't actually have any notes today. I had some things I was going to talk about, but this is kind of a momentous week, and so I thought, you know what, I'll just talk about that, because my mom did pass away on Saturday. So I thought I'd just talk about that, my reflections on that. And then also, hey, I'm driving down the street here at Maranatha and there are 5 deer standing out there looking at me. Looks like about 3 boys and 2 girls. So I need to kind of practice anyways for the funeral because both myself and my brother are giving eulogies and I know what I want to say. And I've thought it through and that kind of thing, but I thought, well, you know, it can never hurt to have another little practice session because, frankly, I think what I have to say is important. So anyways, we'll get to that in a moment. My mom did pass on Saturday, July 22nd. The official time of death was 2:45, pretty much towards the end of the week. I may have mentioned this last week. She was sleeping more and more and more and more, and I actually hadn't talked to her for a couple of days because every time I swung by, she was sleeping, and I didn't necessarily want to wake her up, and I had talked to the nurse, and I said, yeah, she's sleeping, and the nurse said, yeah, she's sleeping a lot. Well, I got a phone call Saturday morning. Oh, it was about 10 o'clock or so. And the nurse at Maranatha said, I just want to let you know that I haven't been able to wake your mother up. Persistently unconscious was actually an important milestone because Mom had signed advance directives. And the advance directives had said that if she becomes persistently unconscious, that everything stopped at that point. Everything, including food. That's what she wanted. So, okay. So I asked the nurse at that point, I said, what do you think? I said, I know this is extremely difficult to make any sort of prediction, but in your experience, what are you thinking? And she said, it's going to be soon. She said, it could be the next 15 minutes. It could be today. It could be tomorrow. I said, all right, well, I will finish up on a couple of things here, then I will head in. So then, of course, I made the round of phone calls. And then, of course, the phone calls came back and more information back and forth and back and forth. In addition to the fact I was in the middle of making sauerkraut, so I finished that up. Grabbed a shower and prepared for the long haul. And so I eventually then got to Maranatha about 1:30. And they had a really nice recliner in her room, so I just kind of camped down in the recliner. I had called my dad to see if he wanted to go over and see her. I kind of explained what was happening, and he said, you know, just call me. I said, okay, because, you know, they've been married for 67 years. It was going to be 68 years in November, so some of these things are difficult. And he's 94 and easily fatigued at this point, so I said, I'll call you, Pop. So I had gotten there, and once I got there, I was pretty glad that I didn't bring him down. Because Mom was to that stage where she was gasping. They had oxygen on her. Technically, if she was really in a persistently unconscious state, we should have taken the oxygen off. But, you know. But she would lay there for a moment, and then she'd gasp, and then she'd lay there for a moment, and then she'd gasp again, and they had already increased her comfort meds to, you know, keep her comfortable. And so I popped open my computer and started working on my writing, because you just never know how long it's going to be, and started doing some editing on book 7. And about 2:15, I got a text from my cousin Patricia, and she said, "Hey, I heard about your mom. You know, I've just gone through this with my mom," which she had just a couple of years ago. She said, "Call if you need anything." And I said, "Well, I appreciate that." And I was texting back, and I had told her, since she had been through it, I said, "Yeah, mom is gasping at this point." And I looked up, and mom was real still. And I kept looking at her. And then suddenly she gasped again. And I thought, okay, well, not yet. But I told Patricia that, you know, it's slowing down. And Patricia said she understood. So I wrote for another, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes or so. And then I looked up and I looked at her, and, you know, she wasn't moving. And I kept looking at her and waiting, and she wasn't moving. And finally I crawled out of the recliner and went over and, you know, checked her pulse. Couldn't find a pulse. And then leaned down and listened. Didn't hear any air moving. So the nurse had told me, "Let me know if something changes." So I went out to talk to the nurse, and I said, "I am no expert, but I think I may be in need of one." And the nurse said, "I understand." Grabbed her stethoscope, came in, she listened, she said, "Yeah, she's gone." And she said, "I'll need to get another nurse in here, and we'll need to confirm." I said, "I understand." So they actually called. I think the time of death was around 2:30, and they called it at 2:45, and, you know. So then, of course, everything, there's a whole cascading series of events that comes out of that. And so I had called Dad and told him I would be by to see him, gave him the news, told him I was just wrapping some things up. And then when I got, by the time I got to see him 15, 20 minutes later, he told me, he said, I've just been sitting here rejoicing, because all morning I've been praying, Lord, just take her home. And her sister was actually praying the same thing. Her sole surviving sister was praying the same thing. And so it was a very peaceful, aside from the gasping, it was a very calm and peaceful passing, and everyone was ready. So we have the funeral coming up this Saturday. My brother's coming in Friday night. He's going to be leaving on Sunday, but we'll have a little time with him here. And so that'll be good. You know, I've got an amazing team. It's just an amazing team. My wife, my daughter, and my son-in-law. I mean, my daughter had written and said, "Do you think we ought to have lunch over at Pop's tomorrow, just so he's not alone?" And I said, "Yeah, that's a great idea." So I left the house at 11 o'clock, my house at 11 o'clock. We all started scattering to go our separate ways about 3 o'clock. And in those 4 hours, I cleaned out Mom's room. I picked up the meal for us. I did some grocery shopping. I got it to the house. Everybody pitched in, got the table set, ready to go. We sat down. We had a meal. I had to leave. I went and met with the funeral director, went through all the preparations for all that kind of stuff, got an action list, came back. Meanwhile, they had put together a rough obituary. I finished up the obituary. We put together an order of service. We contacted the minister. They had gotten all down all the pictures and organized them for the display that they were going to make. My wife had gone in, picked out clothes. She did subsequently pick out some other clothes. But, I mean, everything was just rolling. You know, it was just rolling. And by the time we broke up and went our separate ways about 3 o'clock, we basically had everything ready. We had bunch of little details that were in our action list, but we got an amazing amount of work done in 4 hours while we were having a meal. And in fact, at one point, Nett broke off and went up to meet some friends who were just coming through for a few minutes. They had a new baby and they were traveling through Springfield, so she talked with them. And so it's just amazing. I have a great team, just a great, great team. So I think we're all good to go, and you know, we're ready. There were a few additional things that had to be done, but those are in place now, and my wife went by today and saw my mom after they had made her up and done her hair, and mom said, you know, or my wife said she looks fine. She had lost some weight, so you know, she doesn't quite look like she does in her pictures, but that's okay. That's okay. She's free of her battle of dementia at this point. So I've been, you know, as soon as mom died, I started thinking about funeral, and I thought, you know, there's really only one thing I want to talk about, and that is seven words. Seven words that, at least in my opinion, unquestionably revolutionized my life. And while there's all kinds of stories I could tell about those seven words, I'd like to just focus on three stories, and actually two and a half. I think I've told this first story on the podcast before. It's not a story that I actually recall happening to me, but my mom told it enough about me that I feel like I can faithfully retell it. It was during our first term in the Philippines. And apparently I had a toy. It was a little plastic toy. My mom called it my monkey. I don't know if it really was a monkey or if it was an astronaut or some kind of a pilot. Maybe it was a little figure of a monkey astronaut. I don't know. Anyways, it had a little parachute attached, and the game was that you'd wrap the parachute around the monkey, throw the monkey up in the air, the parachute would deploy, it would float to the ground. I would stand out behind our house doing this over and over and over, because this was before the internet. So, you know, children then were easily amused. On this particular day, according to my mom, something happened. I don't know if I lost track of it, if I wasn't paying attention when it came down, if the parachute didn't deploy, but apparently it fell in the long grass, the tall grass behind our house, the large field of tall grass. I had lost my monkey. This apparently greatly disappointed me, so I came tearing back into the house. I found my mother in the kitchen and proclaimed my disappointment. I have lost my monkey. Without hesitation, my mother invoked those seven words. Have you asked Jesus to help you? No. Go back out there, ask Jesus to help you, and then start looking. Okay. And I trotted off. In the kitchen with my mom that day, there was a man who was visiting us. His name is Colton Wickmaratna. Powerful man of God. He was actually discipled by my parents during their first term as missionaries in Sri Lanka. Went on to become a powerful preacher, traveled the world speaking, signs and wonders, followed his ministry, became the leader of the work, the Assemblies of God work in Sri Lanka, pastored a huge church. Amazing man of God. He was in the kitchen that day. And when my mom told me to go out there, ask Jesus to help me, and then start looking, after I disappeared from the kitchen, she reports that he looked at her and said, "Sister Farrand, what will happen if he doesn't find it? What will that do to his faith?" Now, I told you about Colton ahead of time because I wanted to make it very clear that Colton was a man of faith. He believed that God was an ever-present help in times of trouble. He availed himself of God's wisdom and God's guidance. He lived in that every day. So I don't think there was any question in his mind that God could speak to me. I think if he was concerned about anything, he was concerned that perhaps I was too young to hear. But see, Colton didn't know something that my mother knew. And what my mother knew was that that was not the first time she had said those seven words to me. She had said those words to me over and over, and she had instilled in me an expectation that when I asked Jesus to help me, he would. From what my mom would say when she told this story, this discussion between her and Colton about my faith and what not finding this toy would do to my faith continued for a few minutes longer. But it was shortly after she had sent me out that she said I came trotting back in hand, trotting back into the kitchen, smile on my face, my monkey in hand. That's just one story of many, many stories that I could tell you and have told you in these podcasts about God as an ever-present help. There's one other story that I'd like to tell. This one strictly concerning my mom. Because Mom didn't just recite these words to us, "Have you asked Jesus to help you?" She lived them, which was a spectacular thing to behold. In our second term as missionaries in the Philippines, there was a day when Mom came marching into the house and announced, "Bill," talking to my dad, "Bill, we have got to do something about that library. We've got to renovate that library." And my dad said, "Alvira, I don't have the time. I've got too many projects right now." And she said, "We have got to do something about that library. It just looks awful." And my dad, frustrated, said, "Alvira, if you want to do something about that library, you go ahead and do it." I'm getting my mail. One moment. And my mom, in typical style, said, "Okay, I will." At which point, my dad said, "Where are you going to get the money?" And Mom said, "I'll pray it in." A couple of weeks goes by. She comes into the house, waving a piece of paper. She starts reading a letter from one of the churches that supported them from the pastor. Said, "Brother and Sister Farrand, I was praying the other day and you all came to mind. Here's a check for $1,000. I don't know if you've just started a recent project that you need some money on, but I felt like I should send you this." Over the next little bit, my mom, I prayed in, I think it was $15,000, which this is in the 70s, so that was a significant amount of money, still is. I'm backing into my garage. She prayed it in, but it didn't stop there because Mom had never run a building project before. And so her approach to running a building project was to get all the workers out there, all the Filipino workers, and they would spread out the plans and they would lay their hands on the plans every morning. And Mom would pray, "Oh God, help us this morning to understand these plans and understand what we need to do." And they would pray. And a couple of months later, the library was renovated. Have you asked Jesus to help you? You know, I can think of nothing that would make my mom smile more than for those who hear these stories to take those seven words and tuck them away in their hearts for the next time they need them. Are you discouraged? Have you asked Jesus to help you? Are you distraught? Have you asked Jesus to help you? Are you confused? Have you lost your way? can't find your keys? Here's where the half story comes in. A couple of years ago, we were having a family breakfast or a dinner, I forget which, and Liz and Alan, my daughter and son-in-law, and the grandkids were down. And at the end of that dinner, I looked over and Elizabeth was frowning as she shuffled through her things. "Everything okay, sweetie?" I said. She said, "Can't find my keys." And I grinned. And then I asked her what I have often asked her, just like my mother often asked me, "Have you asked Jesus to help you?" And it was so fascinating because she said no, paused for a moment, a beat, maybe two, and then she said, "Oh yeah, they're over there." Just like that. Now, not all the answers come that quickly, but that one made me smile. But I can tell you that in my life, as I have meditated on these seven words, as I have used these seven words to remind myself and then to ask, sometimes it's then necessary to seek. Sometimes it's necessary to pursue and take action. But I have found that eventually I find an answer when I ask Jesus to help me. Seven words. Seven words taught to me by my mother that have profoundly affected my life. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.